Well, hello, I'm Steve, alcoholic. Did you notice how the last three folks came up the stairs? That young guy came up three steps at a time. And then that next guy is a little younger than me. He came up there one step at a time, and I had to have help. So you got to look a lot to look forward to if you're young. I don't know, sometimes I drift a little bit negative, and, you know, I think the fix is in here. You know, I think I got set up. Okay, we got Bill Sanders, Jewel, Joe Walsh, and Bill Wilson, and then me. What's up with that? Who does that to a guy like me? Anyway. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be sober. I want to thank Bill and the committee for asking me to come down here and speak. It's a privilege and an honor to speak anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, and especially at any kind of a men's workshop. I love going to men's workshops. Out in San Diego, we have the Back to Basics workshop in May and October. And that was started with a seed offering from this workshop right here. They voted to give us $500 to get it kicked off the ground, and we've been doing it now for quite a long time. So thank you very much for helping us start that out there in San Diego. And I'd also like to thank Doc, who was a host for Big Al and I. He didn't drive us around. What he did is he was the co-pilot up in the front with Al, who's a little bit slow to begin with, and I'm in the back seat so I can't say anything, and Doc is giving him directions, and he's going, turn left here. No, right. No, your other left. You know, and follow that white car. And it was a gray car. And we're right down in the middle of the hood in downtown Atlanta. It gets pretty exciting when you're with Doc down there, you know what I mean? Before I get too far into this, I'd like you to do me a favor and just stand up. And I want you to reach over to that guy next to you or around behind you, give him a hug, shake his hand, and tell him, I'm glad you're here. Yes, sir. Hey, Al, give that guy his wallet back, man. All right, we're all loosened up here. Let's have a good time tonight. Let's have a good time tonight. Sobriety rocks. Yes, it does. Sobriety's about having fun. I'm going to tell you a story. Now, I want you to understand something. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a story. It wasn't a true story, but it was my story. As a matter of fact, I had to work myself up to being just a liar. I was a fabricator. I just made shit up as I went along. And the good people in the medical community call that delusion. You may have noticed that book is used frequently, or that word is used frequently in this book of Alcoholics Anonymous right here. And I suffered greatly from delusion, and still do, I'm sure. But my story starts out when I dropped out of the chute on October the 7th, 1942, in Detroit, Michigan. Right on. And and my mother and father got divorced in 1945 when I was 2.5 years old. And I can well imagine that they probably had a few high-volume discussions between 1942 and 1945 when the divorce happened. And what they did is they sued each other in court, in divorce court, for the other person being an unfit parent. And they paraded witnesses, family members, friends, neighbors, and they built a case against each other. And the judge agreed with both of them. You're both unfit. And he made myself and my sister wards of the court. And we were to live with our maternal grandparents, and visitation rights would be given to the parent of that maternal grandparent, or the child of that parent. And the judge made a decision without knowing it, and that was going to affect me in a very dramatic way for a very, very long time. Because when I was 5 years old, I came in late, after dark, and my grandfather took a fly swatter handle. Now, this was 1947, and they didn't have, like, those little things that drop down and catch flies. You had to swat them. And so they made them out of that handle out of steel, and it was rather sturdy. And he pulled my pants down, and he beat me with that wire fly swatter handle until I had bloody open welts from the middle of my back to the middle of my knees. And for the longest time, I put that in a little box. You know how we like to do things. If there's something we don't understand, we go get a little box, and we put this little box, and we put it on the shelf over there, and it doesn't exist anymore. So anyway, what I put in that little box was, I knew that he was wrong. I knew that no child deserved to be treated that way. And I knew that I wasn't wrong. And that's the box I had it in. In 1951, 52, right around there, the court order for the maternal grandparents having custody was never changed, but the family kind of changed it up, and we started living with our parents. And so I went to live with my dad in Missouri. And when I was about 11 or 12 years old, I lived on a farm in Missouri. We went to little one-room country schools. They had them dotted all over the county. And down at this one little country school, not the one I went to, but I knew everybody that did go to that thing, and the little building fund that they build up with change and stuff like that, it got stolen. And the word was out pretty quick of who did it, and all the kids knew. And my dad asked me if I knew anything about it, and I said, yeah. And he said, well, who did it? And I said, Dad, don't make me tell you who did it. You know, I mean, that ain't right. And he said, no, son, the right thing to do is, you know, that was stolen. And so I told him who did it, and he put me in the car, and he took me into town, and we went to the sheriff's office. And the sheriff promised me that this would remain completely and totally anonymous and no one would ever know if I told him who did it. So I rolled over on him, told him who did it, and within, oh, I don't know, an hour and a half, everybody in the whole damn town knew. And so here I am, I'm 12 years old, and I had my grandfather, my father, and an officer of the law betray me. Put me together. Beat me. And what happened is I shut off, and I shut down. And if you can't trust your dad and your grandfather and your sheriff, who in the hell can you trust? Answer, nobody. And that's exactly who I trusted for the rest of my life. Until very recently, if you want to know the truth. And so I didn't trust anybody, and I was shut completely off. I felt nobody's pain except my own. I raised myself, and you poor folks have lived with the result of that ever since. And if you're new, I want to tell you some things about Alcoholics Anonymous so I don't forget. First of all, AA works, and it works real good. That's the good news. The bad news is, we're your new friends. You know, laughter is a marvelous and wonderful thing, and if you're new, you're probably going, what the hell are they laughing about that for? Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, we have a very dark sense of humor. And second of all, we were all that new guy at one time. And a lot of you folks came in here just like me. I didn't have a friend in the world. Nobody had told me keep coming back. They told me, get out of here and stay gone. And in the end, I suffered loneliness as few human beings ever will and ever have to. I wished for the end. I wasn't the jumping off spot. I just wanted to die. I just wanted to go away. But you see, I had a 22-year drinking career. The first 20 years of it, I did not have a drinking problem. I had a drinking solution. Because the first time I drank whiskey, it took me over to a place called I Like It Like That. I Like It Like That. I love the effect of alcohol. See, what alcohol does to me that it doesn't do to other people, it produces an entire psychic change in me, and I become a different person. A different person. People that metabolize alcohol correctly and don't suffer from the phenomena of craving, they may amplify their personality, or if they're feeling depressed, they may feel a little bit more depressed, but their personality doesn't change. They don't change into a different person. They're just an amplification of who they really are. But me, when I take a drink, there is a new man created. And the new man wants a drink. And then when the new man takes a drink, he wants some dope and a hooker. You know? Until you get your ass tore up from the floor up, that ain't a bad deal. You know what I mean? That ain't a bad deal. As a matter of fact, God Almighty called me out of the darkness of a place called the Pacers Strip Club on Midway Boulevard in San Diego, California. Because you see, on the 7th of October, I turned 38 years old. And I can't remember whether I called my dad or he called me. But we were talking on the phone, and And he said, "Well, how's it going, son?" And I started crying. I said, "I'm dying, Dad. I can't quit drinking. I can't quit doing dope. I can't save any money. I can't keep a job. I want to kill myself. I just want to die." And all those things, my dad said, "You got to do something about your drinking, son." Now, I'd had several of these driving while intoxicated things. Drunk driving, they call it. And the last one, I had to go to a class in El Cajon, California. And there was a guy there named Ken M. And he was a 13-year sober man. He was also the director of treatment at this drug and alcohol rehab in Coronado, California. And the first night I went in there, I was dressed like this because what I was a high-pressure salesman. And I was dressed kind of like this, and the rest of the people were dressed kind of like you. And well, it is what it is, okay? I'm usually dressed like you, okay? So, you know, let's get that straight. Okay, and so I said, you know, what's a nice guy like me doing with all these people here, you know, in a drunk driving class? I mean, I wasn't really drunk. I was sleepy. So I wear hearing aids now. And the reason I wear hearing aids is because I've got a hearing problem. And if you get hearing aids, you can help solve that problem. And see, but that's a really wonderful thing, because most of my life I've had a listening problem. Not a hearing problem, a listening problem. I don't listen. I don't listen to the friendly warnings along the way. I don't listen to the people who had my very best interest in heart and in mind when they said things like, "Why don't you quit drinking? Why don't you quit smoking dope? Why don't you quit going to jail? They're all connected, you know." I said, "What do you know about it?" So anyway, the second week with this Ken guy in the drunk driving class, I noticed something different about him. And what was different about him, and I'd never been to AA before, but I'd never seen this thing where a guy doesn't tell you what to do, he tells you what he's done. And he talked about the alcohol problem and what he did about it. And he didn't tell me what I had to do. Because this is a good time for it. Because there's basically three positions we can take in this thing called Service and Alcoholics Anonymous. We can be a preacher, and that should be very, very rare. Or we can be a teacher, and that should be very, very rare. And what we can also be is a reacher, and that's what we need to do, is to reach out. However, I want to take the role of teacher for just a very short time, so bear with me. Okay, there are six words that most of us are incredibly familiar with that we can do a little bit better at this thing called living life if we lose them. And those words are, "Don't tell me what to do." You ever think that way? Come on, man, I'm not the only one, right? Don't tell me what to do. Okay, now the cure for that is six words divided in two. And the first one is, "I was wrong." And the other one is, "I don't know." Now, if you say, "I was wrong" and mean it, and you were wrong, and "I don't know" and you mean it and you don't know, then those other six words are more or less canceled out. That's the end of the teaching and instruction. I'm going to go back to my sad, pathetic story. So the second week, I noticed this guy has something about him that's different, you know. And in the book, it talks about this indefinable something in the eyes of the men. And that's what was there. He had that indefinable something in the eyes of the men. He gave a shit about me when I couldn't and didn't. And I was still shut down and shut off. And I cared about nobody but myself. And I'm in this class, and he cared about me. He cared about everybody there. And so I started to listen. And the way he presented it, I knew at the end of that 6 weeks that I was an alcoholic and I could not drink alcohol, period, because it was bad news for me. And I had 20 years of proof. And so at the end of the 6 weeks, when we graduate and you get a little certificate, I said to him, Ken, I want to really thank you for the way you laced this program together. It's made all the difference in the world for me. I know I'm an alcoholic, and I'm never going to drink again. And he goes, really? And he's about this tall, right? A little short guy. And he says, what are you going to do about all that rage and anger you have? So I put my best fake it till you make it smile on. And I said, thanks for the information. And I take off down the stairs. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, because what I really wanted to do, I wanted to be the AT&T company, you know, reach out and touch somebody. I wanted to just reach over there and squeeze his head like a pimple. But I didn't, you know, because I got to fake it till you make it smile on it. Everything's okay. Everything's fine. And so I walked down the steps and I said, I'm going to show that little sawed-off son of a bitch a thing or two. I'm never going to drink again. And I'm going to get a year sober and I'm going to come back here and I'm going to tell him how the cow eats a cabbage. So that was my first time of swearing off forever. And it worked for 2 days. See, this thing called alcoholism, you know, there's a lot of information available and everything, but I like to keep it real, real simple. And see, this being sober, there's two components to it. The first one, believe it or not, is incredibly easy. You don't drink. You don't drink, and if you don't drink, you don't get drunk. I mean, that is very reasonable and logical. And that's achievable, except for the second part of alcoholism. And that is, we forget that we don't drink. That's what I did. I would quit, and then I would forget that I quit, and I would drink. And then I would forget that I quit, and I would drink. And then I'd quit again. This time, I mean it. It's going to be different, baby. You'll see. That was right after I spent about 2 hours trying to convince her she didn't see what she saw. Yeah, I'm through with the drinking, baby. You're right. My heart is broken in 1,000 pieces on the floor, baby, and just help me put it back together, will you? Please. Sure, baby. I love you so much. Very, very sick. But anyhow. And then I would forget again. And then I'd quit again. And then I'd forget again. And then I'd drink again. And from 78 until 1980, I became bewildered, baffled, confused. I mean, there were a lot of other things that I set my mind to do or not to do that I was successful at. What's so hard about this shit here? Why can't I do it? Why can't I not drink? I don't want to drink anymore. And in those times when I was drinking, all I could think about was not drinking and being sober. And when I was sober, the only thing I could think about is getting loaded. You might even call that insanity. The book does. And that's what the second step is all about. It's about that forgetting. On page 24, where it says, words to the effect, for reasons yet obscure, the alcoholic at certain times is unable to bring into his memory with sufficient force the memory and the misery and the suffering of a week or a month ago. He is without mental defense against the first drink. That means we forget. We forget. And so that's alcoholism, according to Steve. Anyhow. And I had it, and I had a bad case of it. And so when I was talking to my dad on the phone on my 38th birthday, and I told him, and he told me, you know, you got to have help with your alcohol. You got to quit drinking, son. And I thought of this Ken guy. He just immediately came into my consciousness. Ken's got an answer. Give him a call. And I called him up on the phone. And I made an appointment for the 9th of October, 1980. I was going to go over there and see him about this alcoholism and drug addiction problem I had. And so on October the 9th, I'm down at the Pacer Strip Joint. I went down there because before I went over there at 4 o'clock, I wanted to have a sandwich. After all, it was about... And you know they have really tasty sandwiches. You can tell that when they rip open that little cellophane bag and stick it in the oven. You know it's going to be good. But see, Julio came in with the good dope, and we went out by the dumpster and we smoked a reefer. And anything tastes good then. Yeah. I mean, that little cheesy-ass hamburger tastes like banana cream pie, you know what I mean? And so I'm shooting pool with this guy that I've been gambling with for a decade. And we played for money, we played for drinks, we played for a lot of things. And I missed a bank shot. And he says, you're having trouble with bank shots today, huh? I say, no, drugs and alcohol, that's my problem. Now, that is not the normal conversation in a strip joint. And that was not what I normally talked about when I was in a strip joint. And I went over to sit down on my seat and wait for my turn. And I heard this voice that I believe was what I have come to understand as the Spirit within me. Some people call it the Holy Spirit. Doesn't matter what you call it. And this voice said to me, that's right, Steve, that is your problem. And I don't talk to myself in the first person. I don't go, hey, Steve. I may go, hey, stupid, but I don't go, hey, Steve. And so I decided that maybe because I'd smoked that reefer and had a couple shots of Jose Crazy, and I thought maybe I'd overreact a little bit. Maybe I ought to call this guy up and cancel the appointment and tell him, you know, I got this big business deal coming together, and I just got called out on it. I got to go get the paperwork signed. I stand to make an enormous amount of money, and I'll get back to you and make another appointment. Now, remember at the beginning I told you I made shit up? I made that all up. None of that was true. What I was going to tell this guy, there was absolutely no truth to it. And so I said, well, that's a really good idea. And the voice again said to me, no, go. And I went. I went over to Coronado, California, and I talked to this man that had conducted that class. And the thing that I had done that I didn't know that I had done, that I had never, ever, ever done in my life, and that's ask another human being for help. Oh, I pimped that off that I was doing that, but I didn't really do it. I was trying to impress you with asking you for help. I didn't really want your help. But I really wanted this guy's help, and I asked another human being. And that was the difference, because I had prayed to God. I'd asked God for relief. I'd asked God to relieve me of this alcoholism and drug addiction hundreds of times. And I had hundreds of failures. There's something magic about asking another human being, because there's that connection. You know, and this was a man who was spiritual in nature. This was a man who was prepared and did tell me the truth about what I needed to do. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next day. That was the 10th of October, 1980. And by God's grace, and you people, and this 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's my sobriety date, and the day I started what I call a new way of life. I didn't get my old life back. I don't want my old life back. I didn't want my old life back then. I still don't want my old life now. I want a brand new life. Reset button time. However, the reset button, there's a 12-step program in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I've talked a little bit about the first two steps. I'd like to talk about my experience with some of the other steps, like step three in 1981. I was talking with my sponsor. I didn't know he was my sponsor, but he was my sponsor because he was the guy that was taking me through the steps. And because I had a sponsor, and he was this guy that had a new suit. And the reason I picked him for a sponsor is he had a new suit, so I figured he had some money, and I always needed a loan. So that was the reason I had this guy. And then he drives up in this 14-year-old Plymouth. He spent all his money on the new suit. He didn't have any money. So anyway, I ended up with this other guy sponsoring me that I didn't know was my sponsor. And we're sitting in the kitchen of the Lemon Grove Volano Club, and he says, where are you at with the third step? I said, well, I really don't need to do the third step. He goes, really? Why is that? I said, because I'm a good Christian man. He goes, that's wonderful. He said, you must really know a lot about Scripture then, huh? And I said, that I do. Which was a lie. And he said, then let me ask you a question, Mr. Christian man. How well did that work for you combating the booze problem? I said, not worth a shit, man. He had me. And he said, okay, now, how would you like to do a third step now? I said, I'm down with it, man. So we go out in the parking lot, and the parking lot at that time was not completely finished. There were gravel spots and pavement spots. And so we go out by my truck, and he says, okay, we're going to get on our knees and do the third step. And I scurried over here, like, you know, to get the pavement. And he says, no, no. I get the pavement, you get the rocks. If you want to get the pavement, you take all the steps, start sponsoring people, then you can have the pavement, and the other guy gets the rocks. That was AA in 1980-81. That's how it worked then. It worked pretty good. It kind of works that way with me and the people I sponsor today. Anyhow, we did this third step. And the most amazing thing, because what this guy had told me prior to going out and doing the third step, he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take your Bible and put it on the shelf. And I want you to take your big book that's on the shelf, more than likely, down and start reading it. And don't read the Bible because it's very advanced information. It's too advanced for you. I said, okay, cool. I'm down with it, man. So now here's a guy that tells me to put the Bible on the shelf. And I said, well, when should I take the Bible off the shelf? He says, I don't know. God will tell you. He's always saying stuff like that. What kind of answer is that? God will tell you. So anyway, I left it on the shelf, and we go out in the parking lot, and we do the third step. And when we're done, he puts his hand on my head and says, in the name of Jesus, amen. And I'm going, what's really going on here, man? This guy tells me, quit reading the Bible, start reading the big book. It's too advanced for you, in the name of Jesus. I was already confused. I didn't need that shit, too. I have a little problem. I talked to one old-timer. He'd say, man, you better let go. I talked to another old-timer about the same problem. He said, you better hang on. I feel for you newcomers. I remember what it was like. I fondly remember the first 10 years of my first 90 days. Nobody gives you a break here. You know, because you know what the real deal is on being a newcomer? Here's the real deal, according to me. This is, almost all this stuff's my opinions. But here's the deal on opinions. My opinions are subject to change without notice. Okay, so if I give you an opinion, and Chucky, who lives up here in your head, goes, did you hear what he said? And you start resenting me for having this opinion, and I change that opinion because it's a subject to change without notice, I change it when I'm walking out of here tonight, then you are going to resent a human being who no longer exists. You get that? Okay. So don't resent me for my opinions because they're subject to change without notice. Anyhow, I need to tell you the water story. You know, they always have a bottle of water for speakers. Did you notice that? Now, if you haven't done this before, you probably think that's because we're thirsty. It's not. It's because we lost our place in the story. So we take a little sip of water. Now, where I lost my place, I was talking about stealing hubcaps in Detroit. I forget where I'm at. I take a sip of water. And I talk about getting rolled in the Philippines. And you guys don't seem to mind. You follow right along, man. It's good. This is good stuff here, man. I've been sober 35 years. I've worked this program absolutely as hard as I could the whole damn time. And I am still a mess. You probably gathered that by now. Because I told Bill Sanders, you know, when he called me up, and I said, Bill, look, you're going to have to lower the bar a little bit if you have me come down there to the Rock Eagle. He said, don't worry about it, Steve. We'll throw it away, you know. So anyway, where was I, Al? Huh? Yeah. All right. Third step, right? Yeah, we did the third step. Yeah, okay. And in this fourth step, I found out some very wonderful information about it not too often long ago, about 2 years ago. Because one of the things I did is Jerry, who was my sponsor and took me all the way through the steps the very first time, and before I had any kind of understanding of that admonition that's in the third step in the 12 and 12, where it says, nothing short of continuous action on the remaining steps will bring about the desired result. Okay, now for you guys like me that graduated from high school untouched by education, the translation of that is nothing short of continuous action on the remaining steps. And that's what I had to do. However, Jerry died, and I got another sponsor, me. And I sponsored myself for a number of years. And there's a saying in AA that I found out was true in my case. If you're sponsoring yourself, you have an idiot for a sponsor. And that's exactly what I had. And the real reason behind all that stuff is, how can I be objective about myself? I am the subject. With me, I am the subject. I can't be objective. I can be objective about you, but I can't be objective about me. So I need help. But you know, I'm that guy that's shut off, shut down. I don't need anybody. I don't trust anybody. Jerry asked me, before we even got involved in the steps, he said, you trust anybody? I said, no. He said, nobody? I said, nobody. He said, your mom, dad, sister, brother? I said, nobody. He said, do you trust me? No. I said, well, that's really too bad. Because here's the deal. You're totally and completely powerless over alcohol. You got a mind's on the way to the liquor store, and God's got the job you want. You got a real problem, pal. And if you don't find one human being you can trust, you're going to die drunk. That got my attention because I didn't want to die drunk. And so I trusted Jerry. I said, okay, I'll trust Jerry. And I trusted Jerry. And Jerry took me through the steps a couple of times. And it made a huge, huge difference in my life. But then he died and I started sponsoring myself. Had an idiot for a sponsor, I told you that. I've always sponsored other guys. I've always been of service. I do H&I work and all this stuff that they say, you know, you got to do this stuff. So I never questioned, you know, should I do it? I just did it because that's what they do here. And there's a place that I've arrived at several times in my life, in different areas of my life, and it's called the end of myself. I arrived at the end of myself with drugs and alcohol in October of 1980. I arrived at the end of myself in 1986 with my rather terrible behavior with women in AA. And I arrived at the end of myself here not too recently when I asked a guy named Sam 2 years ago to be my sponsor, and I'd been my own sponsor for 15 years or whatever it was. And we've been going through the steps. I just did the sixth and seventh step with Sam before I left California, and I came down here with the idea of getting busy on the eighth step. But Al and I have been having so much fun, I just haven't found time to write, you know what I mean? We've had a good time. We've had a good time since we've been here. But I'm committed 100% to the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, what happened to me is I had an entire psychic change and a vital spiritual experience as a result of taking the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This word vital is used in the book several times. It's an interesting word. What it means is necessary for life to continue. And the book tells me I have to have a vital spiritual experience. If I want my life to go on, I have to have this vital spiritual experience. I cannot make that happen. I can't pray that into existence. I can't wish it into existence. I can't do anything except follow the directions that are in this book. Because because for you other geniuses in the room, I'm a genius you know, ask me, I'll tell you. You know, in the beginning of the book, in the, I think it's a preface to the first edition or second edition, one of those things with Roman numeral pages on it, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, what that tells me is there's nothing for me to figure out. Later on in the book, it talks about clear-cut directions. And they are clear-cut directions in this book of Alcoholics Anonymous on what to do. The problem is that if you've got a mind like I got a mind, and you've got a personality like I've got a personality, and you can relate and identify to some of the things I've been saying, you need help from another human being. No matter what your education level is, no matter what your age is, no matter how long you've been sober, I need help from another human being. Now, there's this thing, identification, which is a little bit different. It's kind of related to I relate to you, but identification is sometimes in the area of something that surprises you. For instance, the first thing I identified with in meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy that he said, you know, I've never been in prison, but I've planned 10 prison breaks. I'm sitting there less than 30 days and I'm going, there's another human being that thinks like that? That's identification. That's different than relating. But you can get carried away with this identification thing. Because I'm 73 years old. We have a guy in the Misfits, which is my home group, Misfit Men's Group, and his name is Art. And we use monikers there. And we call him Old Fart Art because he's like 80-something. Sober over 40 years. And one night, he's walking towards the restroom, and I said, hey, Art, where are you going? He said, I'm going to go in here and shake hands with the unemployed. I identified. I didn't want to identify, but I identified. I don't want to tell you I identified, but I'm telling you I identified because I'm supposed to tell the truth up here. So when I get through talking here, I'm going to go shake hands with the unemployed. I want to talk about the couple of men that have made a huge difference in my life. One was a guy named Eldon Scott. And he was 23 years sober when I got sober. He talked with a large, booming voice, a man's man, you know, the real deal. And he got cancer in 81, 82, right around there somewhere. And he had a very bad kind of cancer. It was metastasized very rapidly. It spread very rapidly. And he went from that retired mailman, real man with a booming voice, to a guy that walked with a cane, to a guy that walked with a walker, to a guy that had to be taken to a meeting in a wheelchair, to the guy who laid in his bed and they took a meeting over to him. All in a period of about 2 or 3 months. That's not the part of the story that affected me. Scotty was sitting in the Lemon Grove kitchen, and a young lady, Scotty at that time was 68 years old, and a young girl came in and says, oh, Scotty, I'm so sorry to hear you got cancer. That's just so, it's just heartbreaking. He said, young lady, do you have any idea how happy I am to live long enough to get cancer? And I heard that loud and clear. how grateful he was to live long enough to get cancer. And Scotty died with dignity, and they had a memorial. And man made just a big difference in my life. And when I was about 7 years sober, I was really nutted up one night, if you know what I mean, where you got those eyes where there's not an indefinable something in your eyes. There's rage, anger, hatred, resentment, and all other kinds of evil all wrapped up into one in there, and everybody knows you're crazy. Even the crazies know you're crazy. And I've been hearing this guy named Paul Connors, who's sober maybe a year and a half, 2 years longer than me. And I've been hearing him say in this morning meeting, you know, at 9 o'clock I go 10 toes up and I unplug my phone. If you want to talk to me, come over and see me. I live at 555 Dawes in Pacific Beach. And he'd say that all the time. And so I heard it all the time, and so I knew it. And so here I am, it's about 11 o'clock at night, I know he's 10 toes up, he's got the phone unplugged, and he lives at 555 Dawes Avenue. I go over to 555, I knock on the door, and nothing happens, so I knock on the door again, and he comes to the door, and he goes, "What?" And he opens the door a little bit, and I look at him. He opens the door and says, "Come in. Please come in." And I came in. And he started putting on his pants. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "You and I are going to go down to Denny's and have some coffee and talk." And I said to him, I said, "I mean that much to you that you're going to do that in the middle of the night?" He said, "Right now, Tekin, you're the most important person in the world." And he meant it. And we went on to Denny's. And I've had that happen several different times with several different people in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I didn't reach out for help. I broadcast the fact that I needed help out of every pore of my body, and somebody, the exact perfect person, came at the exact perfect time and helped me without me asking. That is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the power of this wonderful, wonderful fellowship. You know, I've got 8 minutes left and I'm done. So, I want to thank you men for giving me the most important thing you have, and that's your time. I want to thank you for allowing me to come down here and share my story. I hope it helped, and I got one more favor to ask. Anybody that's got over 20 years, would you please stand up? All right. Now, these men that are standing up, you new guys, get over and talk to these guys. You get over and talk to these guys. These guys know what's going on here. God bless you. Thanks for letting me talk.